Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Jonathan Pultz. John is a Los Angeles Police Department SWAT team leader, investigator, trainer, and crisis negotiator. John has been rewarded with over 100 commendations for his work throughout his career, and he is the author of the book, Negotiating Like Lives Are on the Line. Throughout his career, John has applied his skills and techniques to a wide variety of situations. He's negotiated the peaceful resolution to countless crisis situations. He's applied them in criminal investigations, and he has also applied them in workplace situations and family conversations as well. And I'm really excited today to talk with him about how he applies his philosophy and techniques across the board in all of these conversations. And I'm really excited to talk to him about some of the things he relies on the most and he feels are most important, including the power of giving people options and the ownership that comes with that, addressing both instrumental and expressive needs, the difference between spotlighting and processing information, and one that I really like, his three-step process for solving problems. All great information and so much more that I'm so excited to get into with John today. But before we do, want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. First, we have HumanTel. For everybody who is interested in developing the skill set of understanding what people are likely feeling at any moment, by identifying fleeting changes of emotion on their counterpart's face and then their nonverbal behavior, please head over to humantel.com. Check out their best-in-class, self-paced online training and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the training of your choice while you're there. I highly recommend it. I've done it myself. Please head over to humantel.com. For the investigators who are listening, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com for the International Association of Interviewers. That's where you can learn more about their networking opportunities, their peer-to-peer resources, their online and in-person educational events. It's also where you can find out more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation, if you or your team qualifies, the process of earning that designation, and what that designation could mean for you and your career moving forward. All of that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That is where you can learn more about the programs that we are asked to facilitate for our clients when they ask us to teach their CEOs, leadership teams, sales teams, and HR teams the ethical observation and persuasion skills necessary to encourage people to share their everyday confessions. All of those programs and more can be found over at inquasive.com. Of course, thank you all for taking the time to continue to join us week after week for these conversations. We do truly appreciate it. So now without further ado, Jonathan Pultz. John, it is so great to see you. Thank you very much for carving out the time from what has to be a hectic schedule to have this conversation today.
Yeah, Mike, I appreciate you having me on. I'm looking forward to the conversation today.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine, man. So I read your book, Negotiate Like Your Life Depends on It. Every time I say a book title, I get panicked that I said it wrong. I did say it correct, right?
You're right there. Negotiating that lives are on the line.
Lives are on the line. I apologize.
No, I read
your book and then saying the title wrong right out of the gate. So
we're all
thank
good.
You no for problem. Correcting me.
No, thank you for reading it. I appreciate it.
Oh, I enjoyed it, man. I really cool. did. And in fact, right out of the gate, I want to ask you a question about a little piece in there that I found fascinating. So I feel like if you put your background and my background on a Venn diagram, there's a little bit of overlap there. I'm not going to pretend that they're anywhere near the same, but there's a little bit of overlap.
No, absolutely.
And one of the things that I try to work with people on is help them understand that their word choice matters. And that things that they say, which might seem innocuous, or they might even think it's rapport building, could be the absolute opposite. And you had a little line in your book about avoiding antagonistic phrases. And the one you had listed there, I thought was great. Let's end this. And I would imagine that for a lot of people, like if it doesn't even have to be a hostage situation, you're trying to help somebody. I have a young son. I'm trying to get him to collect himself because he's upset we're running late and get in the truck so we're no longer running late. Like, so if I was to say, come on, man, let's just end this little episode and get in the truck, that could even be antagonistic. So I would love to open up the conversation here And can you please start by helping us understand how something innocuous as "let's end this" can actually be an antagonistic statement?
Oh, absolutely. Like you said, choice of words matter. And it's the little things sometimes. If you're dealing with someone who's suicidal and they're elevated platform or they have a gun to their head and you're saying, "Hey, let's end this." It doesn't take someone, too much to think about, hey, how that choice of words right there can lead to an immediate resolution of that problem in a way we don't want. You know, if sometimes that can be challenging. So I like to use words like, hey, how can we work together to resolve this situation? Or how do you see us bringing this to a conclusion is in a way that's positive? I'm a big believer in giving people options and how to resolve their situations, especially in my line of work in crisis negotiations and being an LAPD SWAT team leader, because generally people are in that situation. They feel like that they don't have any say in the situation. And by humanizing and allowing them to solve the problem, a lot of times it leads to that peaceful resolution. And the reason it does so is because in this sort of work that I do, most of the people find themselves in these situations spontaneously. They're not deliberate, hostage takers. They're not deliberately trying not to go to jail. Some are, and those are the ones that you're probably going to have a difficult time resolving verbally. But the majority of them just panicked. They may have bad backgrounds, like they've been arrested before. They may be gang members, whatever it is. But on this day, you just caught them at a bad time. So by choosing your words carefully and by working with them to resolve the situation, a lot of times I can go into these situations and solve them, even though different officers or different entities have been there for hours before I got there, and be able to solve it. And it starts with the little things, like you said. And before we started this podcast, when we were talking to each other, we talked about, hey, how do you like to be addressed? Simple things like that. I had a negotiation a few weeks ago with an individual who was suffering from mental illness, schizophrenia, paranoid delusions, and he got upset with his mother and chased her with a butcher knife. Interestingly enough, when the police showed up, he lived on a block where his family pretty much had grown up. So he ran to his grandfather's house. And I thought that was kind of interesting. But the first thing I did, his name was Sivandro, which is totally a unique name. So the first thing I asked is like, hey, does he go by Sivandro or does he have a nickname? What do you guys call him? And they're like, yeah, he goes by Nito. For the 2 hours before I had arrived, no one had addressed him as Nito. No one had wondered why he ran to his grandfather's house. So I started digging in, talking to the family members and going into the reasons why they thought he went there and trying to see him as a person. So talking about like what words we choose when we address things and not being antagonistic, building rapport, it's the little things when we communicate with one another, we meet one another that bring us together no matter where we come from. So if we could humanize people, if we could try not to bait them into some sort of antagonistic relationship, it's huge. And I know you're a forensic interviewer, right? And that's a big time deal when you're talking to people who are suspected of possible wrongdoing. You know, certain phrases like, why did you do this? You know, just something as simple as that can bring about, you know, accusatory action. It's definitely better, in my opinion, to use things like I statements or open-ended questions that aren't antagonistic or accusatory. And that opens up the conversation. It builds rapport. And then we can start to find a resolution on issues.
So many great points built into that. And even when you talk about the people that you end up having conversations with, being spontaneous, most of them didn't plan to run from law enforcement, to barricade themselves, to take a hostage. I'm imagining, especially today, there is a larger percentage of people you deal with that either have mental illness or have mental illness or mental capacity issues, maybe brought on by substance use and things like that, which changes the math in those conversations and things. But even if we think about people that are thinking about, well, how do I apply this to a business conversation? How do I apply this to an employee? How do I apply this to a customer? How do I apply this to my family? Well, how many times a day do we make a spontaneous decision based on how we're feeling in the moment? And if the moment or the feelings were different, we would have made a different decision. Yet because our decision violated somebody's expectation or their perceived moral code, or even the amount of time they feel like they have available to deal with it right now, they end up responding in a way where they're trying to, so now this would be like the manager or the teacher or the parent or whoever, ends up responding in a way to satisfy their own needs instead of the immediate emotional needs of the person that they're hopefully trying to help. And some of these things, like, let's just end this. Well, how can you care about me if you're trying to rush and end this? That's not where we're trying to start. Giving people options, such a huge point. And you talk about that in your book as well, the power of giving people options. That might sound counterintuitive to somebody who thinks, well, wait a minute, if you're talking to emotionally heightened suspects that may or may not be criminals in these types of situations, what are some of the benefits of giving people control of at least part of their own decision-making process?
Well, it makes them feel like they're part of solving the issue at hand. And like we talked about, going back and humanizing people, especially people who are under the influence or they have mental illness, a lot of times they feel worthless. And that's what kind of drives them to these situations. It's what brings them to this moment, is they're so frustrated because they feel like they don't belong in society, that they don't matter to anybody. And they do. I mean, there's people that care about them. There's someone's, you know, daughter, son, father, mother, brother, sister. I mean, they have family and people do care about them, and they've just gotten to a point where they end up in these type of situations where they feel like nobody cares about them. And interestingly, we talk about, you know, emotionally reacting to things. And that's something I think as communicators that happens on a regular basis. So generally when you're in these crisis situations, you're dealing with people with two types of issues. They're either, they have instrumental needs or they have expressive needs. So generally expressive needs is people are, they're emotional and they're angry about something. It could be they're involved in a domestic situation. They blame their significant other for their problems. It could be they blame society for it. It could be any number of issues. Instrumental is someone who you talk about using it in a business type of atmosphere, is they're looking to achieve a certain goal. You know, maybe they're looking to get promoted or they're looking to spend a certain amount on a car or a house or whatever it is. And by identifying what your counterpart is talking about, do they have expressive needs? Do they have instrumental needs? You can find your solutions that way. But a lot of it comes down to, we just kind of got to listen to what people have to say. And quite often, especially in my profession, is we're very used to telling people what to do, right? Instead of listening to what they need. So then you start confrontation. So by listening to people, and sometimes just shutting up and letting them vent or letting them speak, you learn quite a bit. You can learn, what is their problem? Is it instrumental? Is it expressive? Is it a combination of both? And what are the things that you can do to assist them in solving that problem? Because if I tell you how to solve your problem, you're going to ignore me, right? That's not what we want to do. If we tell people how to solve their problem, it generally doesn't work. But if we guide them in a direction on how they can help solve their problems, and then if they ask for our input, I generally respond with something like, well, I think, because I can only tell you what I think might work. I can't tell you what you think might work, but we have a tendency as a society to tell people what we think they should do. And that's a big thing. But with the book, the reason I wrote it initially, it was for law enforcement officers. And the more I thought about it, I was like, well, as I became more and more fluent in these type of skills, they're universal. They work everywhere. They work in a business setting. They work in a family setting. They work in a counseling setting. They work in a law enforcement setting. And for example, you talked about using it in a business set. My daughter recently started driving and I had to buy her a car. And so I did all my research and I knew what it was I wanted to spend, but I hadn't bought a car in quite some time. And the last time I bought a car, I paid cash and I thought, hey, you know, cash is king. I could walk into a dealership. You know, I have this amount of money. I know what I want to spend. And talking to the salesperson, I was getting a lot of resistance on what to pay cash. And I recognize that this isn't working. I know we're in the ballpark as far as price goes. I know that this is what I want to spend, but for some reason, I'm not able to close this deal. Why am I not able to close this deal? So I just simply looked over to the salesperson. I said, you know what? How do you make money on these cars? And when he found out that I'm looking to work with him to make money on him, he was more than happy to help me. And his answer was, hey, sir, right now, you know, when I make money on these cars, I make it on, you know, the add-ons, the accessories, and loans. And I said, okay. So tell me about the loans. And he went through all the different various loans. And long story short, I would say, so let me see if I understand this right. If you get me to take a 7-year loan at whatever it was, you know, 8.5% interest over over that time period, you make the most money because you get an incentive. He's like, yeah. I said, okay, perfect. This is a simple interest loan, meaning obviously, you know, we could pay it off right away. Give me that loan. You get your incentive. I get to pay the cash price I want. I'll pay it off in a week and we're all happy. And you know, so just by listening to him and asking the right questions, I was able to get what I wanted. He was able to get what he wanted and everyone was happy when we walked out.
A great example is, excuse me, I'm sorry.
No,
that's a great example. I picked a bad time for my allergies to flare up. So I apologize for that.
Don't.
All too often we think the battle can be over one specific thing and it's not. There's plenty of times where we can get what we want and allow somebody else or even make it easier for somebody else to get what they want. And to tie that back to giving people options, and I'd love your thoughts on this. I truly believe that in a lot of contexts, the best way to maintain control is to give up a proportionate amount of control to the other person. Because when they feel like they don't have control, they don't have power and safety. And if I don't have that, I'm going to fight. So if we can give up whatever is the proportionally appropriate amount of control, depending on the situation, obviously a hostage negotiation is going to be different than a conversation I might be having. But now we can reduce their barriers and bring them into the conversation to help facilitate that resolution.
Oh, I agree 100%. And, you know, it just goes back to treating each other with respect, regardless of the circumstances. I mean, if once one party decides to take away that respect, it can get pretty ugly. But by giving people options and being an active participant on how to solve a problem, they're naturally get drawn in because that's just the way we're wired. We are generally communal in nature, and we want to work together and collaborate with one another to solve issues. And generally, you know, some people say they like working by themselves, but we see the greatest results when we work as a team. And even if we're adversarial, if we can work together as a team, then we can achieve great things. And you see that all the time. You see it like in the court system. You see it in government. It doesn't, you know, they always show the negative parts where people are conflicted on things, but when our legislatures are working together, they often come up with some pretty incredible results. Same thing in courtrooms. When the two sides work together, they can often come to a resolution between the two parties that works for both, satisfies, you know, a potential victim or whatever is the problem, and or, you know, civil litigant, and they come together, find a solution, and they make it work as a whole. And that's basically, you know, we talk about in communication, regardless of the arena, whether it's crisis or business or, you know, mediators or interviewers, we're all trying to get that common goal is to figure out what's the best solution to our problems. And we just got to figure out how to work together. And by providing options and allowing our other parties to have input on the resolution, then it's going to lead to a better outcome. And generally, those parties are going to be more satisfied. If someone tells them exactly how it's going to happen, like if a judge or an arbitrator comes down and says, hey, this is how it's going to be. No, you can't appeal this. No, you can't question it. You have to live with it. And that's it. Generally, people will be pretty dissatisfied. But even in something like a barricaded suspect who's, you know, doesn't want to go to jail, if I give them options on how they can resolve the situation and how I can leave them with a little bit of dignity, they're going to be a lot happier than they were if, you know, we have to go in there and yank them out.
That leaving people dignity and allowing them to save face is so critical. And I feel like all too often, especially in emotional moments, people in leadership positions don't allow that to happen. Like the win for me is to make sure you feel bad about this. The win for me is to make sure you know you were wrong. The win for me is to make sure you apologize. No, the win for me is hopefully the path of least resistance to the strongest outcome where we can all walk away feeling a little bit better about this. So I guess if we were looking at kind of a neutral business type scenario that can be easier to imagine without getting into details, I'm sure it's an easy assumption for me to make that you've had to have some conversations with some people who did some objectively reprehensible things. Not all, but a few of the people that you've spoken to. But yet they had to have some sort of dignity in order to be able to choose, hopefully it was their choice more often than not, to walk out of whatever building or situation that they were in. How have you learned to compartmentalize your maybe morals, values, judgments, not sacrifice them, but kind of keep them in a box in order to help people preserve their dignity and take some control to arrive at a positive outcome?
So definitely a lot of training, a lot of experience, a lot of growing up, right? So I think it all started when I was a teenager. I was a dishwasher in a seafood restaurant. I absolutely hated it, right? I'd go home smelling like fish. And so the following summer, I saw an advertisement for a lifeguard. And I thought, hey, you know what? That's cool. I can swim. I'm in good shape. I can hang out on the beach. I can meet girls, right? But it was anything but that. There was some of that. But what I found out real quick was that I became a professional problem solver at that first job. And it was things where people had drank too much. They wanted to fight on the beach. They were arguing over, you know, a small real estate of sand on the beach, parking, you name it. Any argument that occurs out there, it was just like my job today as a police officer. So I started finding out that I could work with these people and help them solve their problems. A lot of times allowing them to solve their problems helped me. But as I progressed through my career, I found out that, you know, especially when you're younger, there are people out there that will definitely challenge you, especially if they're under the influence of alcohol, drugs. And when you get heated up and you snap back, it's obvious, like we talked about, you have two antagonistic personalities going on one another. It's going to lead to, you know, at least a heated verbal argument or a fight. So mental preparation before I go into a situation like this, whether I'm doing it on a tactical side or I'm doing it on a negotiation side, I already prepare myself for the fact that whoever I encounter is probably going to be on a level of 1 to 10 emotionally. They're probably going to be at a 10 and they're going to be redlining. And I understand that I'm going to have to work. It's going to take time. It's going to take patience. And there's going to be a process to work through. I'm going to have to figure out what the problem is with the person. How are we going to work together to solve it? And what are the steps that I can really do to help them? And when I say that I really can do, I'll get pretty outrageous requests sometimes. It'll be, hey, I'll come out right now if you know, you get me an ounce of cocaine, or you know, you get me a bottle of Crown Royal or whatever. It's so a lot of times stuff like that is not going to happen. And honesty is a big thing. Is I'll tell them, hey, I can do A, B, or C for you, but I can't do that for you. But putting myself mentally preparing to know that I'm going to be yelled at. I could possibly be shot at. I could have things thrown at me. I could be spit on. People are going to try to bite me. I know these things are going to happen. So when it happens, I'm not surprised by it. I'm expecting it. So when it doesn't happen, it's even better. And I just look at it as, okay, let me build rapport. Let me be empathetic with this person's situation. Let me keep working towards finding this resolution and bringing this person down. So by not yelling at them, listening to what they have to say. And every once in a while, because I do deal with some very nasty people, I will have to transition. So there is a time sometimes in negotiations where I do have to ramp it up. We call it hardball, where I have to get antagonistic. But for the most part, it's a process. And I'll start on that low end, try to bring them down to my level, try to rationalize with them. And then if I have to ratchet it up, then I'll ratchet it up.
And there's a couple of questions I'd love to follow up there. But when you said that last, I'm going to start there with the hardball, the ratcheting it up. From my own outside perspective, I feel like, and taking it out of your context, of course, I feel like a mistake I see a lot of people make in business, in parenting, I coach youth sports on ball fields, is people go like right to the ultimatum, do this or else. And because they go right to the ultimatum, they get maximum resistance. They don't get the outcome they wanted. And now they're in a place where like, I've got two choices. Actually, I got three. I can come up with a worse ultimatum.
Right.
I can renege on the ultimatum and lose all credibility. Or now I can enforce an ultimatum that I never wanted to enforce anyway. And to tie it back to the patience and process you mentioned earlier, I know in your situation, there's like protocol that you're following. So that's going to guide part of it. But just as a thought process for human beings, based on what you've learned, how would you recommend people work to avoid going the ultimatum or hardball route until all other reasonable alternatives have been exhausted?
Well, I think you have to know your counterpart too. You know, what's their demeanor? What are you dealing with? I always advise people, planning and preparation is probably the most important part of any interview process or any negotiation. I spend a ton of time on the front end trying to find out as much about my counterpart before I actually go down range and talk to them. So do as much research as you can on the front end. If it's spontaneous, I think that's where active listening comes in, is you want to definitely see what their demeanor is like. You know, what are their body cues telling you? Are they tense? Are they amped up? Are they, you know, yelling? What type of words are they using? Are they trying to be antagonistic? Are they almost look like they're trying to pick a fight? Or do you see some reasonableness and pick your route carefully? But I would definitely say you want to try to bring the conversation and the tone, your body language. If it's face to face, you want to be on an equal platform where you're trying to calm them, listen to what they have to say, let them vent, let them get it out. If they challenge you, if they lie to you, if it's nothing you have to address, just let it roll off, right? Just if you know they're lying, what's the worst thing that you can do if you're trying to calm them? If you challenge them on it, they're just going to amp up and they're going to challenge you back on it. Right. So it's just best to either, you know, slightly acknowledge it or even ignore it at some point. I'm a big proponent of deflection and redirection and things like that. If you know that there's a certain subject that's amping them up, that's probably not a direction you should go, right? I like to talk about hooks and triggers. Hooks are generally subjects that you can build a rapport with someone. You want to focus on those. Triggers are just like they sound like. They're the type of things that are going to set people off. Sometimes you can use triggers to engage in dialogue, but just be very careful on how you do it. And so that would be my thought process is, if I'm dealing with someone who's angry, who's antagonistic, and instead of going for that ultimatum, start low, work your way up, keep it in your back pocket. Even people who negotiate from a position of power, even they are very good about holding that as a last resort. And a perfect example of that would be, you know, let's say the electric company, right? The electric company, they keep raising their rates, and they get people that call and complain about it. But at the end of the day, your calls for complaints aren't going to change your rates. They're not going to change it, but their customer service is fantastic. They have a lot of empathy. They're like, oh, you know, I'm really sorry to hear that you're paying this much more for electricity. You know, what are some things we can do about it? And they try to work with you, but at the end of the day, you're not going to change anything there. You know, if you like to drive fast, they're not going to change the speeding laws. So people you talk to at the end of the day, that their last thing might be something like, well, you know, we're trying to work our best, but you have to understand nothing's going to change. It's the way it's going to be. But the delivery of it is the important thing. If you have an ultimatum, like, especially, I know dealing in coaching, you have parents that are very demanding. They get so emotionally involved. Hey, my kid has to play. They have to do this. They have to do that. It's like, slow down. I'm going to do everything I can to get your son or daughter some playing time. But at the end of the day, I'm the coach and I make these decisions for a reason. I'm willing to try to make them better so we get them more playing time. I'm willing to listen to how you think we can make that happen. But right now is not the time and the place. Right now, this is the decision we're going with. And I'm sorry if you don't agree with it, but that's the way it has to be. So the delivery of it also makes a difference. And just being honest, is there some people that doesn't matter what you do or what you say, they're going to be jerks, and we just have to live with that. And that's the way it is. But we can't take it personally. We can't let that affect us, because when we do, that's when we talk about, we start pushing back, and you just made a situation you know is bad. You can make it terribly worse.
Let's pour gasoline on an open fire.
Absolutely.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
When you talk about, and I'm very thankful there are men and women out there like you doing the jobs that you do. For the majority of people who are listening to this conversation, hopefully they don't have to worry about potentially getting shot at or spit on or bit or those kinds of things. But for most of us, there is potentially a negative cost of doing business for what we do. People might yell, they might swear, they might threaten, they might disagree. Maybe for some of us, there could be some physicalness that may or may not get involved. But even if you take it down to the lowest end, they huff, they roll their eyes, they cross their arms, they turn away from me. And people get, I work with CEOs all the time. I'm furious at this guy. Why? He rolled his eyes at me. Well, what did you expect him to do? Like, are we 14? We're gonna tank this whole thing because some dude rolled his eyes? Like, let's dial this back a little bit. So a really good point there about working as hard as we can to try to depersonalize things to the best that we can, at least in the moment, and understand the greater context of what we're working in. When we logged on, you mentioned adjusting your schedule, which I'm grateful for. And the line you used was called out. And so I'm pretty sure that in your schedule, like, you can't look at your weekly calendar and say, well, I'm going to be on a rooftop on Wednesday afternoon at about 3 o'clock, and I'm going to be in a back alley on Friday between 10 and 11. So here's where I'm going to make my dentist appointment.
Right.
I'm guessing your schedule is completely beholden to when other people make regrettable decisions in some way, shape, or form. And to bring that back to a lot of people that I currently work with, Murphy's Law, you mentioned that before. Problems don't typically arise at a convenient moment for us. Nobody ever knocks on our door and says, do you got a minute, when we've got a minute. A customer never calls with a problem or a change when it's actually good for us to address it. People manipulate time in negotiations all the time. They could have brought this issue to us 3 weeks ago, but now they want it up against the deadline because they think it gives them power. In reading your book and hearing you even just talk about patience in preparation, I feel like a lot of times when people are either inconvenienced or rushed, feel rushed based on somebody else's actions, they prioritize the time of response over the quality of response. And these are in scenarios that 99.9% of the time are not life-threatening. Like, okay, maybe a rent check is in the balance, or maybe a job is in the balance, but I can probably go get another one of those if I had to. You're dealing with this when lives are on the line. I would love if you could to please speak a little bit about the importance of slowing down to speed up and making sure that we are preparing and considering the context before we engage, even when we're inconvenienced and time is a problem.
Yes. So time and patience, it solves a lot of problems, as we know. But as a society, like you mentioned, Michael, we're extremely rushed. We want things done. We want them done now. But a lot of problems, like you said, they come at a time, whether it's inconvenient or not, they're going to require a timeline to be resolved. And we can't push it. Sometimes by pushing it, especially in my profession, you don't have to look far to find the examples. When we rush through a crisis situation, things can go bad, and they can go bad really fast. Like you said, in any situation, whether you're dealing with your children, you're dealing with a spouse, you're dealing with business, if we don't take the time to properly address what needs to be addressed, it at the minimum, it can lead to resentment and hard feelings between two partners, especially in a business setting, right? If you have a business meeting that requires a substantial amount of time to work through some issues, and you tell the person that, hey, I'm only going to give you 5 minutes, that person may have a rational reason for only being able to give 5 minutes. But the other person is probably going to be upset because they believe it's a problem that needs to be resolved with more time, and 5 minutes is a slight. But oftentimes what happens is they don't communicate that one another, because there may be a very valid reason why you're only getting 5 minutes, and there's probably a valid reason why they need more than 5 minutes. But instead of communicate, can we schedule it for another time, or whatever it is, they just rush through the meeting, don't get what they want resolved, and then there's resentment. So the next issue that comes up is probably going to, both parties going to come in with, oh, what is this person going to whine to me about now? Or, you know, I know this person doesn't care about what I have to say because they're only going to give me 2 minutes to talk about something that needs an hour. But as far as a crisis situation goes, we talked about it earlier, whether you're dealing with mental illness or you're dealing with narcotics, just having the time to let the effects of this wear down or gaining the rapport of someone is important, especially someone with mental illness, because when they tell you they're hearing multiple different voices or they're seeing images of things that we're not seeing, doesn't mean it's not real to them. It's extremely real to them. It may not be real to us, but if you start off the conversation by saying, oh, you're not hearing anything, oh, you're not seeing anything, you've already lost any chance of rapport with that individual. And it goes back to, like you said, a business side. Oh, you don't need more than 5 minutes for this problem. You've already lost that connection with them. So time is definitely important, you know, in order to properly address, you know, whether it's our coworkers, our employees, people in crisis, we have to give them the time they deserve for their issue. Otherwise, they're not going to have that mutual respect for us. They're going to feel like we don't really care about them. We tell them we care about them, but we're not proving that we care about them by giving them the time they need to either vent or address their situation.
I love the way that you said that. We can tell them, but we're not proving it. And yep, they're looking for evidence. We can say whatever we want, but they are looking for evidence. And all too often, I'm imagining, especially in your line of work, but it's true for folks that I work with as well, the people we engage with are likely distrusting of us at the beginning of the engagement.
Absolutely.
And it could be somebody, you see in your office every day. You sign their paychecks, but you're still in a superior position to them. So they're more likely to distrust you. They're looking for evidence to continue to distrust you.
Yep.
So now I've got to work extra hard to give them evidence that they can trust me so we can work through this together. And pulling that time away reduces options and control and all these other things. So I love the way that you said that.
Thank you.
One of the other things that fascinates me from the outside looking in, I want to stress that, about the work that you do is the ability to stay calm and focused in immensely stressful situations. So lights, sirens, sounds, people screaming. I'm imagining that there's, you know, people who aren't even involved on the street making a scene around. There's all kinds of pressure. Maybe somebody's in your ear saying you've been there for however many hours, this thing's got to go, you know, whatever. Right. Are there techniques that you have developed individually to help you stay calm and focused when everything around you is saying, don't be calm?
Absolutely. First and foremost, like we talked about, back to planning and preparation, it's training. In your training, regardless if you're doing mock negotiations, you're doing mock interviews, if you're a public speaker, you should be rehearsing. You should know your subject. You should know who you're interviewing. You should have as much background information on that as possible. For me, I look at like professional athletes, right? If you see really good professional athletes, especially like basketball players and baseball players, they generally have a routine. They have a routine when they step up to the plate and they step up to the free throw line, whether it's a certain dribble pattern, it's a certain step or something they do with the bat. What they're doing is they're calming their mind because they can control that aspect of what happens before they step into the realm of the unknown, which essentially all of us, no matter what we do, we have a game plan. We're prepared generally on what we're doing. But when we step into the unknown, we don't know how it's going to, we have an idea in our mind how we want it to play out, but it may not necessarily play out the way we want to do it. So for me, I do all my preparation work. And even prior to that, I have a vest I wear for negotiations. It's got like my pens on it. It's got a place for my phones. It's got my radio. You know, once I put all that stuff on, when I go out in a crisis negotiation, I dress in plain clothes because I don't want to look like the rest of the guys around me from my SWAT team. I want to look like the person you want to talk to. I get my notepad. I start taking notes on the stuff I heard on my way to the scene. And then I go to the scene and I collect all the necessary information. Even before I go down range, I say to myself, how am I going to open up with this person? What's the first thing I want to say? because once you get over that first hurdle, then hopefully things are going to flow. General John Boyd, retired Air Force, Colonel John Boyd, retired Air Force colonel, he developed something called the OODA loop. And I think most listeners and people are familiar with it. And it basically breaks down into a four-part system. It's observation, it's orientation, it's deciding, and it's acting. And you can apply it to so much in your life, whether you're involved in a debate or if you're on the golf course, if you're in an interview, whatever it is, you're observing your situation, what is being presented to you. And if you're talking to someone, it could be something as, you know, what are their bodily cues telling you? What is their tone of voice telling you? What are they upset about? You know, then you're orienting yourself to the situation. From there, you're going to make a decision on how you're going to address that situation, and then you're going to act on it. And it's a loop, which means it's continually going. So as you make a decision and act on one part of it, you're going to re-engage that loop. You're going to observe again. You're going to orientate yourself to how it's going to be addressed. You're going to make a decision on what you're going to do, and then you're going to act on that decision. And you keep going and using it when you go through, and you're going to close the loop once the situation is resolved. And it's one tool to use with all your other tools. Don't rely on just that. Like we said, you're probably going to want to do things that, one thing I'm a big proponent of is during situations is I like to take breaks, right? For a couple of reasons, it does two things. One, it allows me to reevaluate with my team what we're doing and if it's working. Two, sometimes people need an opportunity to digest everything you've just thrown at them. They need time to act. There's a psychologist by the name of Black, and he said something that really stuck with me one time. And I talked about pro athletes and professional communicators, police officers, firefighters, whatever it is. And there's several, you know, CEOs of businesses. When we're in our arena, we have the ability to take in information really fast and process it really fast. You know, we're quick on our feet. We make decisions. We think outside the box. Sometimes our counterparts don't, whether they're, you know, people we're interviewing or the people we're negotiating with, they may not have the same abilities or capabilities. They may have greater capabilities than you to do it, but especially someone in crisis. But what Black said was the majority of people are like spotlights. So if you and I scan the room, or, you know, let's say if Peyton Manning is scanning the field for receivers, and he can pick up which are the open ones, if you, and they process that information quick and they make a decision, where the majority of people are at spotlights, they scan, they see something, the spotlight hits it, it has to come back to them, they have to process it, and then they move to the next area. So that's a big thing that also works to keep me calm, is to know that, hey, if we take the time to not only process for ourselves, let other people process, it allows us to re-gauge stuff. And if you're involved in solving the situation, then you have less time to worry about your nerves and to getting amped up. By focusing on the problem, it can either destroy you or it can bring you to a calm center. And a lot of times too, like we talked about the spotlight analogy, it can help you if you're a fast processor as well. Instead of one big problem, break it down into smaller problems and look at the problems you can solve first. Okay, let me solve this, move to this. And before you know it, by breaking something into smaller problems, you can solve that big problem. It becomes less and less stressful when you see it. So there's a variety of tools I use to keep myself calm and centered and keep my operations flowing. And if one's not working, I don't panic. I'll switch to another one so I can figure out how to use another one to work.
I love the OODA loop tie in there, and then especially at the end too, having the toolbox.
Yes.
So this is how I was staying calm and centered. Well, that's not working. I'm on to the next. And sometimes I get to the end of my toolbox and I go back to the very first tool. Like I used them all. I'm going to go back and start over and kind of work with them again. I think for a lot of us as human beings, especially communicators, in leaders, people in positions of authority, it can be very easy to have expectations going into a situation, especially if the information we have is limited. It's very easy to create expectations or assumptions based on our previous experience in relation to the limited amount of information we have now. And there are lots of cool stories in your book, but one of them that really jumped out to me was the guy who thought the government, I'll just keep it broad, was spying on him through his light switch.
Yes.
And I'm not going to ruin the story for people that haven't read the book yet, but you were able to quickly identify some of the things that he was dealing with and use some conversational techniques to help him choose to walk out all by himself. And even in telling that story and some other ones, you know, here's a guy who isn't a criminal. He didn't do anything wrong. He does have mental health issues. This dude needs to get help. He doesn't need to get arrested. But yet, if somebody drove down that block and saw the SWAT teams and the incident response vehicles and the command centers, they'd be like, oh, so someone's going to jail today, when that's not the case. So what, again, I guess I'll ask, what techniques or what perspectives, how have you learned to continuously evaluate against your expectations? So you don't necessarily go into a situation thinking this guy's a criminal and find out too late it's a guy with mental health problems, that we're constantly evaluating to try to make the right decisions at the right time for the right people.
So the answer for that, believe it or not, everyone wants a magic bullet. How does it happen? You know, how do you do this? How do you do that? What's the one thing I can do? Shut the hell up and listen. That's it. Take the time to listen. We generally want to interject. If it's not appropriate to interject, don't interject. Let them talk. If they're talking, use minimal encouragers to keep them talking. If they stop, ask them open-ended questions. Keep that conversation going. Mirror them. If they say something of interest to you, repeat it. Let them know it interests you. Find what gets them talking. Find what is bothering them. Find out if you're dealing with an instrumental problem or it's an expressive problem. You need to quell their anger. In this gentleman's situation, it was one of the rare ones where it actually was instrumental, because like he said, he thought the government was coming to kill him. And lo and behold, you have a SWAT team on the scene with, you know, guns and everything else, because he
makes it look like the government's trying to kill him.
Right. And he was suffering from paranoid delusions and he had some schizophrenia, but his big thing was he thought it was the federal government. And I, of course, worked for the LAPD. And when I was able to convince him that I wasn't the federal government, I was LAPD, and now we're going to protect him, that his attitude definitely changed. And that was huge. And I would have never, ever got that if I didn't take the time to listen to him and figure out what his problem was. And even more interesting on that individual story was, I wasn't the negotiator that day. I was in a tactical role, and only, you know, by luck, by the position I was at, is we used a robot to go inside the location because we weren't sure if he had left. And he communicated with the robot, and I just happened to be there with the robot, and he was willing to talk to me and not the negotiators on that. So I ended up becoming the negotiator. But again, it just came down to, is I shut my mouth. I listened to what he had to say. I was interested in what he had to say. Even most people are saying, you know, the guy's crazy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He says his light switches are talking to him. And it goes back to what we talked about earlier. For him, it's very real. For us, you know, yeah, he does. He has some mental issues, but for him, it's as real as it can be as our conversation right now. And if we don't understand that, if we don't acknowledge it, we're not going to solve his problem. And I don't care what you do for a living. You're going to talk to people. And for them, you may not agree with their problems. You may not think their problems are real, but to them, they're real. Otherwise, you wouldn't be bringing them up. And if you're in a position to solve them, then listen to them. Listen to what the issue is. Try to figure out how you can assist them in solving them. Don't tell them how to solve them. And like you said, eventually I was able to get him to a point of trust where he thought it was in his best interest to come on out and let us protect him and take him to help. I didn't tell him, hey, you need to come out and let us do this. You know, the only reason it worked was because he decided it was in his best interest to do it. And it all started with me just being quiet and letting him speak and not interjecting when I didn't have to.
I love it. And even that phrase you just said, to go back to antagonistic phrases, I need you too.
Yes.
From one adult to another, That's as antagonistic as it gets. That's me being your parent. Now, when you're playing hardball and the circumstances change, right, there's times we have to say it. But at the early stages and for most of our day-to-day conversation, telling somebody, here's what I need you to do, is a great way to create confrontation where there wasn't any previously.
So it's absolutely a good example. Yeah, no doubt.
So as I was reading your book, I was applying what I was learning to business, trying to put myself a little bit in your shoes, having never done the job, but also to my family. And I have a young son, and one of the things he's very good at is looking at a little problem and saying, but what about this and 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 this? And we went from like needing to finish reading a book before school tomorrow to being expelled.
Right.
The 10 things, they're not going to happen, whether you finish the book or not. They're not going to happen. But yet now we're all the way down the end of this road focusing on these things. And although it's not maybe a perfect analogy, there was a three-step process that you talked about in your book, which, if I recall correctly, was, and I already messed up your title, so good luck.
No, don't worry about it.
Was contain, control, and problem solve.
Yes.
And I love the way you broke it down. And I feel like that applies to so many situations, not just the things that you have to deal with every day out there on the streets. I would be grateful if you could please walk us through how you use that framework and how we might be able to apply it in our lives.
Certainly. Like you said, society, my profession is absolutely no different. The what if syndrome is huge. Well, what if A, B, C, and D, right? So if you work with the information you have at hand and the actionable information you know is good, that's where you contain it. That is your problem. Let's work with the problem that we know that is in front of us, right? Like you talked about with your son, reading a book or having a book report. We know we have to read this book tonight and we have to write some sort of synopsis on it or give a presentation on this book. Yeah, there's all this other stuff that could possibly happen, but we don't know if it's going to happen. We know this is the main problem we're dealing with. So we contain it. We isolate the problem that's most important to deal with. We control it. What are the things that are within our control that we can do to fix the problem? Even as something simple as your son's book report, we know we have this amount of time to do this book report. We know it's this many pages. We know this is what's expected of us. And these are the things that are in our control. We can't control what the teacher's going to say about it. We can't control, you know, how the kids are going to react if we have to present it. But we know we can control this time frame to read it, to put together our assignment, and present it, and then problem solve. You know, maybe our time frame involves us going from practice to home, and then it's bedtime. We have to eat in between. Well, let's see. We can read for 10 minutes on a car ride to practice. After practice, we can fit in another 10 minutes. And then right before we go to bed, I can read it with you for another 10 minutes. So that's problem solve we can do there. Maybe we have to get up an hour earlier tomorrow and we can take notes on everything we read and then put together a synopsis of what we need to do. However we problem solve, we just start throwing out ways that we can fix our situation. And it's no different in any conversation or any negotiation. We are surrounded by these problems, especially in a business situation, because you always get that what if, you know, what if you don't make my deadlines? You know, what if production costs go up? And, you know, during that negotiation, if we can contain the initial issue that, well, you need X amount of widgets for this amount of money, this is what we can do right now within this time period. You've contained that issue. You control it by saying, hey, as long as everything remains on schedule, production costs remain here, raw material costs remain here, we have control of that. We can build in some fail safes for these situations if we do run into problems. And then if we do find this stuff, you know, what are some things we can write in that will problem solve the things that you are concerned about? So using that three-step process, whether it's in a crisis situation, a business situation, a family situation, it does a couple things. One, it gives you a framework to work off of, and it gives you a starting off point, and it allows you something to work through in that situation. Is there going to be sometimes contingencies you have to make? Yeah, absolutely. You know, but at least you have a framework to start with and a direction of travel. And it, you know, if you know where you want to end, at least you have, you know, where you need to start, you can find yourself along the road. There may be a couple of pit stops, might be a couple of side streets, but at least you have a framework to start with. And I think that's a problem when people get themselves into crisis situations or tough negotiations or tough conversations, is they default to emotion and they default to their feelings, as opposed to taking a deep breath and saying, okay, how can I rationally solve this? And that's a nice framework to work with. Contain it, control it, and then problem solve.
I love it. I'm sure I say a million things a day that cause my wife and son to roll their eyes and mumble under their breath. One of them is one problem at a time.
Right.
It's one problem at a time.
Perfect.
Let's not take this too far. Let's not just one problem at a time. Let's work through this and we'll get it solved. I love it. Mm-hmm. I'd love to go kind of away from your book a little bit with one last question. I know you're busy and I really appreciate you sharing your time today.
I love
it. We talked a lot about listening and observing and communicating with the people in the community that you interact with. I also imagine, I have to, because I've never done it, been close to it, that amongst your SWAT team, during stressful situations, communication is critical. The speed, the clarity, like so many things that matter. And you all are trying to talk to each other from, you're seeing different things at different times, getting different commands from different ears. So if we could spin it, so now we're talking about communication within your SWAT team. What are some of the critical lessons you can share with us for intra-team communication during stressful situations to make sure that we all stay, hopefully, unified, focused on the right outcome?
Outstanding question. I'm so glad you brought that up. So in my team in particular, a big thing, especially in the department I work for, in law enforcement in general, is command and control, right? So oftentimes we see things when they go sideways, especially amongst law enforcement, is there's a lack of command and control. And that can be something as simple as you have five guys with guns pointed at someone and everyone is yelling, right? So it automatically confuses, it creates confusion. Plus it raises the blood pressure and the agitation of the officers around because everyone's yelling, oh, he's yelling, he's got his gun. Oh my God, this must be really bad. What we pride ourselves on is if I'm on scene and I'm the person in charge of that incident, the first thing I will do before I even come up is I will designate personnel. Hey, you, if he comes out, you and only you are going to be the lethal cover. You will be the less lethal. I want you to talk to him. I want you to go hands-on. And I want you to do it from here. If he comes out and he comes, I want you to bring him directly to this place. So when it happens, hopefully guys, you know, and generally they're not, they shouldn't be surprised because we've already walked them through. If we actually have a dialogue with that individual, we'll tell them, hey, when you decide to come out, I'm going to talk you through it. And we'll tell the guys when they come out, hey, he's going to come out. He's going to have a cell phone on him. I told him have nothing else in his hands. And we're going to tell them how it's going to come through. I want you to come to this person. I'll be behind these people. I'll direct them where they need to go. But that's something that sometimes in law enforcement, it happens very fast. Traffic stops. You have a lot of these agencies where they have one person working and they're screaming for a backup. And then all of a sudden people are coming in and there's no information flow. All they see is someone fighting or someone chasing someone. And we're all human. But that's where we need to get better is when things fall apart for us, it's a communication issue. So it's incumbent upon someone, regardless of how chaotic that situation is to take charge, start giving real information or the best information that's possible, and tell people what you want them or you need them to do. When we clear a structure, we have a term we call trailer. So let's say we step into a room, we'll call for a trailer, and that generally means that we have something we need another person to handle, whether, you know, it's another door, it's a closet, it's a threat. And what happens is people get so stuck in tunnel vision that they're screaming out trailer, 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 and that trailer will show up. And now you have people who ask for an additional person to help them, but nobody tells them what they want them to do. So part of, you know, training and experience is recognizing that. And for any of us, if we ask someone for help in a crisis situation, you know, maybe there's a car accident and you go to help them and you've got two people that are unconscious and they're bleeding and you're yelling for help, people will probably start coming up, but then you have to take a deep breath. I ask these people for help, but what I want them to do, hey, I need you to go call 911. I need you to try to stop the traffic back there from running into these other people. I need you to help me evaluate these people if we can render first aid to them. I need you to check the cars to see if there's any other victims around. Whatever it is, give people something to do for work, and it does a couple things. One, it helps resolve your problem. Two, it brings them to a state of calm because they're focused on the task. And three, it starts breaking the big problem into smaller problems, which will eventually lead to fixing the situation. So that's the biggest thing as far as, like you said, from a SWAT team perspective, from a law enforcement perspective, is talk to one another. When communication breaks down, the problem breaks down. And that applies universally to several situations. But unfortunately, in my profession, it looks real ugly when it breaks down. And that's what we want to avoid. So anyone out there in a law enforcement capacity, if you're listening to this, that's the one thing is, you know, you do all this high-speed training with guns and tactics and everything else, but we don't do a lot of communication training. And 99% of our job is talking to people. It's talking people, you know, out of crisis. So maybe take a communications class. Maybe read a book on communications. Learn how to be a better communicator. It's going to help you in the long run. And for those times when it does hit the fan, your communication is going to be what gets you through it. And, you know, take it from an LAPD SWAT officer, my communication skills have helped me a lot more than my training in tactical firearms and every other thing I do. Speaking to people is a wonderful skill that you can use across every facet of your life. And when your law enforcement career sunsets, that's going to be a transferable skill that you'll be able to use in the private sector or any other sector you want to use. And more importantly, it's something you use with your friends and your family and the people that matter.
That's a perfect way to wrap this conversation up, man. I had another couple of questions I thought about asking, but I don't want to ruin that point that you just made. I know you've got your book. I know that you're available online. You post, you share thoughts and ideas. If people are learning from this conversation, I'm not going to say if everybody has to be learning from this conversation, for the people that are learning from this conversation and are looking to engage with you further, where should they go to find your book and engage further with you?
So my book can be found on Amazon. It's in both paperback, Kindle, and it's also on audio. So you can look at it that way, but I'm on LinkedIn. You can look me up on LinkedIn, and I'm always learning from everyone I interact with. That's the great thing about it is, you know, I'm more than happy to share the techniques that I've learned throughout the years, and hopefully they can help you. And that's my goal, is to share my thoughts, that situations I've been in, what works for me. And I encourage you to take anything you can that you've learned from me and apply it. And I know I do the same thing. Anything I can learn from people, I'll apply it. And that's what it's about. It's helping each other become better people, helping become better communicators. But either, you know, Amazon or LinkedIn for sure, I'll definitely respond back. I always look forward to new connections and new opportunities.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time today, sharing all your stories and insights. Thank you very much. More importantly, thank you for the job that you and the men and women on your team do. I can't imagine how tough it is, but I know it ain't easy. So thank you very much for putting yourself out there to keep people like me safe every night. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. I look forward to future collaborations, and anything I can ever do for you, I look forward to it.
Definitely, man. I look forward to keeping in touch. And maybe when I find myself back out in LA, we'll find a time to hang out.
Heck yeah. I'd be disappointed if we didn't.
I'll be reaching out for sure. I really appreciate it, man. Stay safe out there. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael. You too.
John, thank you so much for such a great conversation. I really appreciate all the work that you and your teammates do keeping everybody safe. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. So many great ideas in that conversation. I really appreciated the perspective of focusing on the task to stay calm. I thought that was a great point. The power of patience in process, fundamental, worth highlighting. And I thought it was really important the way you talked about focusing on listening to what people need as opposed to telling them what to do. Often we find ourselves in stressful or time-bound situations. It can be very easy to tell people what to do, as opposed to listening to what they need and allowing those needs to lead us to the solution that we require. A great conversation, John. Thank you so much. And thank you to everybody for taking the time to join us today. I appreciate you being here every week. Thank you so much. Before we go, let's thank our sponsors one more time. Head over to humantel.com and enter the code INCUASIVE25 for 25% off all of their best-in-class online self-paced training to recognize shifts in people's facial expressions and body language in order to understand their emotional shifts, what they're likely thinking or feeling in real time. I highly recommend it. I've done it myself. Head over to humantel.com, enter the code INCUASIVE25 to start your training today. The International Association of Interviewers. If you're a professional interviewer, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn about all of their networking opportunities, all of the resources and research available for investigators. That's where you can see their online and in-person training events and learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Do you qualify? Is it right for your career? How do you earn the designation? And what can it mean for you moving forward? All of that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please check out INCUASIVE.com. That's where you can learn more about all of the programs that we are asked to custom design for our clients when they ask us to work with their senior leadership teams, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them how to apply strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences across the spectrum of their business communications. We really do thank you for being here week after week. Thank you so much. Please, before you go, like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show, tell your friends about it. Leave us your feedback so we can focus more on making the changes and providing you with what you would like to listen to during these conversations. I hope you got as much out of this conversation with John as I did. We really appreciate you taking the time. Stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.